I think power results from not being a victim, recognizing that you are the generator of everything in your life.
If we don't embrace death, we don't embrace life.
Life is a practice.
Yeah, that's right.
What you were 5 minutes ago is gone. The past is gone. The future hasn't come. All we have is literally right now.
This is In the Balance.
What we glimpse when we fall in love is our possibility to experience ourselves in a particular way. Mm. And the mistake we make is we think that it's the other person that's bringing these qualities to us. But that actually is not the case. They are evoking what is already in us.
In this second episode in our series on love, I'm having a wonderful discussion with Dr. Jep Saris, who I've had the great luck to find and connect with, and who's been very generous to do this podcast episode with me. I'm Susan Lambert, and we're on In the Balance. And Dr. Saris is really my kind of practitioner. We believe in the same point of view. Right on her website, under her name, she says, "Live life from your heart and soul, starting now." And as many of you may know, if you listen to me regularly, that's what I'm all about. She co-authored a book called Undefended Love with Dr. Marlena Lyons in the late 90s. And I discovered this book, to be honest with you, I don't remember how. But I discovered it in the early 2000s, and I read it for myself. And in fact, the description that she puts under the book says about the book, "Connecting with the person you love isn't just about having a companion or forming a close partnership. Most of us hope for a truly intimate relationship where the connection between us is direct, unmediated, and heart to heart." And so I was working on those kinds of concepts in myself, in my life. I was curious about it. And when I got to know the book and the wonderful information in it and how beautifully it was written, I just started recommending it to my clients right and left for the last 20 years. So I feel that I've done a good deal of PR for Undefended Love, and I feel it's absolutely deserved. She's also these days wrapping her wonderful mind and heart around midlife crisis being a spiritual awakening. She has a course online called Taking the Midlife Leap. So Jep Saris is really looking at midlife crisis, midlife period, relationship struggles, emotional intimacy, the search for soul, living from the soul, and aging. So without listening to me talk about her any longer, let's listen to her. This is Susan Lambert on In the Balance and my discussion with the wonderful Dr. Jep Saris. So I really am very grateful that you said yes to this interview, because I feel like I've known you for years, actually. Yeah, because I've recommended this book, and in many cases, this book has almost been a textbook in my couples work, in my psychotherapy practice, because I find it so wonderful and clear and very accessible, and I've had great response to it. So thank you. Mm. Yeah. So I'd like to just ask you to define for us, what is your definition of undefended love?
Well, you know, the reason that we even use the word undefended, which actually we couldn't find in the dictionary back then, now it's made it to the dictionary, is that what we realize in our practices is that people understand defenses like being emotionally reactive, or when they get triggered, or when they act out. They understand defensive behavior, but they didn't really understand that the entire personality they had adopted was itself created as a defense. And so we wanted to shine a light on that and draw people's attention to how much of the way that they had experienced themselves was actually in reaction to something. And in order to liberate oneself and to experience the depth of intimacy in a sustainable way that so many desire, we had to get people to address the structure that they had adopted more than just the behaviors that they didn't like. So undefended love is the capacity to know oneself and another simultaneously without obstruction. It's an unmediated level of contact that we familiarly call emotional intimacy.
Yeah, I think you and I would both agree that undefended love is something that is very challenging for most of us, right?
It is. It's really a developmental achievement, and it never stops. It's like all growth, all evolution. It's an ongoing, infinitely moving, and therefore exciting, but also, like you said, scary and challenging. But it also, there's some point at which we feel like we have explored the landmass of who we are. And something has to help us get into the ocean of who we truly are. And so the longing, I think, for intimacy and connection and love, that is the motivation.
I don't know if you ever, or if listeners, if you know anything about the musical Into the Woods by Stephen Sondheim, but he has a brilliant song that Red Riding Hood is singing when she's going through the forest and talking about the wolf, and I don't remember, but she says, well, excited and scared. So,
hey, I thought you were going to sing that for a moment.
Yeah, for a minute I might have, but that's the whole thing, isn't it? That love is exciting and scary, period.
That's right. That's right. We have this deep, deep yearning to have this unmediated contact with ourselves and others, and we have this fear born from early experiences in our lifetime that we will not be able to tolerate the rejection or the experience itself, almost like a fear of meeting God, because in a way, intimacy is this deep meeting with the divine or that which is larger than us. And so we have this desire to be a part of that which is larger than us, and this tremendous fear that the loss that will come from that will be devastating. And so that's what we're trying to really enlarge ourselves in this process. In the midlife work, I often talk about, if you picture a glass of water next to a beautiful, pristine blue mountain lake, and you put a teaspoon of salt in the glass of water, and a teaspoon of salt in the pristine lake, when you drink the glass of water, it's going to taste bitter and offensive, and we're going to be repulsed by it. That same teaspoon is easily absorbed into the pristine blue mountain lake. We want to become that lake, and we start our journeys out as that glass of water. So we're constantly saying no to anything that might taste bad to us or feel dangerous to us. But very little feels dangerous when we are the size of a lake and can absorb and digest and transform whatever comes to us.
That's beautifully said. And I think that also I would add to that that it's also the feeling sometimes with people that their fear becomes, it manifests itself in, that's a lot of work, I can't do that work.
Well, that's true. Impotence. Impotence is another form of expression of fear, mm-hmm. right? I can't. And that also is a defense, by the way.
Yes.
It's not actually what I would call an authentic level of fear, although there is some authentic fear in that. There's an origin mm-hmm. that was authentic. But by continuing to hide under that I can't mantle, we're actually ensconced in a defense not to actually have a direct confrontation with the authentic fear.
Yeah. So staying with this idea, but getting a little bit more specific in terms of falling in love, love, and how couples gather, I'm also interested in you speaking to the very beautiful writing, which, by the way, the entire book is beautifully written. You're welcome. How you would describe what you write about as the heart of intimacy and then the central dilemma that we have.
Okay, well, as I mentioned, sometimes the phrasing, because it's such a part of my past, I'm not remembering exactly all the phrasing, but
no worries.
What I can say is that we've been speaking about the central dilemma, which is longing for intimacy, but really afraid of, I guess, opening our kimonos, dropping our guards, letting down our defenses in order to have that direct, unmediated experience, which was experienced in our childhood, and there was subsequent wounding around that. So that's the central dilemma that we're talking about. Definitely, intimacy is a spiritual practice. It is the journey of moving through the defense structure we created, which I want to say is a necessary and actually in and of itself a developmental achievement. Everyone listening and you and I are here because we created a structure that would allow us to move in our families in a safe way and also within the collective in a safe way. And so that defense structure is a developmental achievement, and at some point itself must let go. It becomes itself an obstruction, very much like an acorn husk must give way for the seed of the oak tree to be born. And the spiritual part of that journey is when the seed takes root, is born. That journey is what kind of oak tree is this seed going to become? And as we can look in a forest, or I live in Oakland, so there are oaks everywhere here, we see that every oak tree is different. There are no two oak trees that are the same. So that journey of becoming our unique selves within a collective environment is a spiritual journey. And we have a longing, a deep and abiding longing, whether we are aware of it or not, to experience the essential core of who we are. Now, you know, often people say, well, what, you know, I don't get it. What's essence? What's essential nature? What's personality? You know,
yeah.
Those distinctions can be, you know, unclear. Certainly in the beginning, they can become unclear. And so the metaphor I use in Undefended Love is if you think of the nighttime sky, mm-hmm. and the stars, think of those stars as cutouts, and that there is a light coming through from beyond, through those stars. But there's each individual star, and no two are alike. Our essential nature is that shared light that is pouring through the star of us, the essential self, the shape and form that's unique of us. And so that's a distinction between essential nature, which is shared, essential self, which is a unique presentation of that shared light. And then I suppose, just thinking about this in the moment, I suppose that personality, in a way, are all the lights we have going on in the planet that drown out the beauty and impact and direct contact with those stars. And yeah. So we have to go a little bit into the darkness to see ourselves. And that can be scary. The collective here has an attachment to drowning things out. And so there is a part of this journey, a regular part of this journey, where we have to go into the dark side. Not meaning the bad side, but meaning the less blaring, loud, stimulation-driven side into the quieter, depthful, maybe darker realms of our being.
I appreciate you talking about this in this way, this idea that we become very attached to that time of falling in love.
Yes.
And wanting to grab that and keep it and seeing ourselves in it, having that early falling in love almost be the mirror that we're looking into rather than going inward. And I love the way that you talk about finding the way to continue to be in love, but in this connected way also to ourselves, as you're describing. And what happens, I think, often with people, if you agree with me, is that, you know, we can become easily disappointed, or you know, it's hard for people to make that shift to be going deeper within oneself and in a relationship from that initial time.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, a lot of people who kind of giving falling in love somewhat of a bum rap, and I think it's just a really important experience in one's life. And what we glimpse when we fall in love is our possibility to experience ourselves in a particular way. Mm. And the mistake we make is we think that it's the other person that's bringing these qualities to us. But that actually is not the case. They are evoking what is already in us. And it gives us that very necessary experience of ourselves as that large blue lake. And then the loss of that and the plummeting back into that small glass of water that has to defend itself from every teaspoon of salt, that initiates a lifetime journey that is very important. And I think love is one of the most potent ways for that journey to be initiated. So we need to build in, and older people certainly know this, less so for younger people, but having fallen in love a number of times, we pretty much know later in life that there is going to be a period of vast opening, which we love, and that is going to be followed by everything that obstructs us from abiding in there, that large experience with another. And so in a way, it's a tremendous opening act. And what you're saying, and I agree wholeheartedly, is that if we cling to the other being a certain way so that we can experience ourselves a certain way, we are protracting our stay in dependency and not liberating ourselves to become that large lake that can be present with whatever's happening in whatever way it's happening, with an open heart and a clear mind and a capable way of reacting in an appropriate way.
Yes.
So falling in love is really important. And I start some of the workshops asking people to remember what that was like. And I have to say some people resist that because it brings so much pain to them that they're not having that experience. And if those who are courageous enough to bring that in, you see the room transform. Just them remembering, the room becomes open and available and spacious, and all of these essential qualities come pouring in.
Wow.
Well, and then as you said, the work begins, right? That's the opening. Now we have a glimpse of what's possible. And then the actual work begins to see what are the obstructions to abiding in that openness.
Yeah, and I want to read from your book a couple of things that relate to this that I think are just what I like so much about this book. And mine's very raggedy at this point because I have a lot of notes and pages turned down and, you know, envelopes sticking into pages I want to always refer to. so there's one section that you call the fire of our internal struggle. I'm just going to read a little bit of it. We can consciously choose to love in an undefended way without waiting for life to orchestrate a circumstance that compels us to do so. This does not mean artificially changing behavior, suppressing uncomfortable emotions, or pretending problems don't exist. We cannot bypass or transcend what lies within and between us, but inquiring into how we might feel if we had very little time left with one another can shift us off our quote-unquote position. We can recognize that life gives us a choice: defend against and reject our experience, or accept our vulnerability and let it be a source of guidance, which is in a way what you're talking about now. I know it's not exactly related, but, mm-hmm. And then you say, When we simply remain present in the midst of our dilemma, the fire of our internal struggles softens our hard places and sharpens our insight. Our dedication to love with an unguarded heart offers us the opportunity to use problems in our relationships as avenues to the core of our being. So beautifully said, and is, I think, really what you're talking with me about today so far.
Yeah, the thing that a lot of people, at least who come to me, they think there is a way of getting this right, mm-hmm. doing the right thing, saying the right thing. Some people have become very skilled at right communication. Mm-hmm. But if the transformation hasn't preceded that communication, then it will fall apart under press. And so the fire is very important. There's a holy fire, which is the longing to know ourselves and each other. But there's also the fire that's like under the pan of us that is mixing the ingredients, say, of a couple and producing a third being because of that cooking. And so we have to be able to stay in the kitchen. We have to be able to stay in the pot and surrender control regularly, allow ourselves to be cooked and changed and to be surprised by what comes forward. And that is an intimate moment, actually, because yes. We're not in control of it. We're open to it. We are allowing life to move through us. And we're allowing life to do with us what it will, with the faith that evolution is good, and that we will, and we gain this faith over time as we see each time we kind of go through what I call the black hole, this darkness where we become lost and unguarded. Every time we come through, we open up into this vastness, this spaciousness, this field of love that no longer sees ourselves, experiences ourselves as separate or judging or blaming. It's kind of a vast field of acceptance. So that fire and the disruption, that's a necessary part of the journey. And from my life experience, that never ends. The only difference is that later on, once we've been through this a number of times, we recognize that, that discomfort is the fire of transformation that precedes the experience I'm longing for.
And this is why I feel, listeners, that this is a very important discussion that we're having, that I'm having with Jet Psaris. Because, you know, we also know the reality of, let's say, many people will stay in an unhealthy, unhappy, kind of miserable relationship for many, many years because they're more afraid of change and the unknown than they are of misery. Or, you know, exactly what you're talking about, this idea of letting go of, or not letting go of, but letting go of the fear of knowing that there's some discomfort. That exists sort of in the Buddhist study too, you know, tolerating suffering and getting to the other side, or even just in regular old psychotherapy. How much do we talk with our clients about us all, me included, I've been there and I've struggled with it, tolerating uncomfortable feelings in order to get to the other side, rather than pushing them down or denying them or distracting ourselves will keep us in the shadow and the darkness, right?
That's right. In fact, the one of the tickets into this level of work is the willingness to say yes, whether we experience it as uncomfortable or pleasurable. You know, the ability to know that there's kind of a fundamental ground of goodness and to say yes to life as it presents itself. And I always do add the same cautionary statement that you were referring to. That does not mean staying in a relationship that is in fact abusive. It's that, in that case, you're saying yes to your own sovereignty and your own healthy self-protection. But there's always a looking for a yes. And and one of the ways of doing that is if there an experience presents itself, asking the question, what am I trying to avoid here? Or what experience am I trying to get here? And if you can answer either one of those questions, you are operating within a defensive structure. If you're trying to avoid something or you're trying to get something, you actually are trying to control yourself or others or an outcome. And that in and of itself is a pointer, oh, there's a defense here. And so instead of continuing down that path, working directly, as you're talking about, with the discomfort that you feel if you don't engage in those manipulative or controlling behaviors of trying to get and trying to avoid.
Yeah, it's big. It's a big, big challenge. Big challenge for everybody. So how can couples begin to learn this together, not go to the default of guardedness? How can they or we feel and see the difference? And along with that, what would be some specific elements or tools that couples can implement or foster that are relating to more of an open-hearted way of being with each other? Like, I'm bringing you sort of into the how-to practical a little bit more, but going on these big ideas. So how do we make this, how do we cultivate this and bring it into our consciousness and then actually, you know, make it proactive together?
Well, you know, the first non-negotiable ticket, as I was mentioning earlier, but to state it in a different way, mm-hmm. is that a couple needs to agree, line up in themselves with the understanding that what we experience in relationship is a reflection of an internal state of being. Mm-hmm. Until we take responsibility for what we're experiencing, we're going to continue down the slippery slope of blame and judgment. I talk about this couple, and I can't remember the content exactly. I remember their names, Stacy and Hal. Mm-hmm. And they came in, and Hal had a complaint of Stacy. And he went on and on about it, and then was a little surprised when we turned to him and asked him to explore his complaint. And he became very offended, pointed out that he was paying for the session, not she, and that why were we turning our attention to him when she's the problem? Well, we're not going to get very far with Hal because he hasn't gotten that first step, which is that he has to see that this has to do with him. And one of the difficulties of working with clients, with couples who have been together for 30 or 40 years, is that that first step is often a little bumpy. If you've had five relationships and you continue to fall in love with emotionally unavailable men, you know that has to do with you. It's not totally about mankind. And so that is a really important first step. And it takes a while, I think, to truly do that. But if you impose some self-discipline, and the way I state this for couples is I ask them not to critique, evaluate, comment on, psychoanalyze, or have anything to do with characterizing their partner's behaviors or who they are for a period of time, like 3 months, not even to allow themselves to think it. What they immediately confront is a sort of blankness or a fear because they have to turn their attention to themselves. And so that first step is interrupting the power struggle that keeps them other focused and avoiding this initial stage of blankness or emotional discomfort over what arises. Those two things are incredibly important. And then developing an interest in what's showing up in you. So you're turning your attention to make contact with yourself first. I reassure everyone that we will, in fact, hold the partner accountable for behaviors at some point, but only after we can take 100% responsibility that the experience we're having has something to do with us.
You know, I know you're going to have more to say. I'm going to dive in at that moment because I can't be more emphatic about how much I've come into that discussion in my own life and in work with my clients. The thing about, you know, I think that in 2017, we all have a lot more exposure to a lot of issues and topics in wellness, in mental health, in couples work, in fighting fair and intimacy, vulnerability because of the internet, you know.
Right.
You know, we have, you know, a plethora of information that we didn't have even 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Yes. However, I think that even though we're inundated with this information, I don't know how much we really sit and say, yeah, I need to really believe that there are things inside me that are working with me, on me, and in all my relationships and all my endeavors that are origin of how I'm doing and how I'm communicating. It's so much easier for us to default to being reactive to what's happening to us or how we think it is. And what I love about what you said, to be always very curious about what's inside us and what's happening and how that's coming out in everything we do. Curiosity is very powerful, very powerful tool.
Yeah, arguably the most powerful tool, because curiosity has embedded in it openness.
Yes.
And openness has the release of the tension that actually our defense structure is comprised of. Our defense structure is a contraction. Even if we're explosive, it's still a contraction. Mm-hmm. So if our partner comes in late for the 1 billionth time, mm-hmm. you know, we can either explode again for the 1 billionth time or withdraw again for the 1 billionth time. And what that does is it maintains a sort of comfort zone. We know that territory, even though it may feel uncomfortable and we may say we don't want that. It's comfortable, it's predictable. We know the path and we know that we can find our way back to each other, but we're not going to have that experience you talked about at the opening of this talk about the direct confrontation with the fear of not being in those defensive structures. So it's revolutionary when someone comes in late, to every time they come in late, to use that as an invitation to explore why that is so challenging for you. And so, you know, you might start by saying, well, you know, I have these thoughts about it. For one, you're wrong. It's disrespectful. It makes me feel like I don't matter. And so any thoughts you have, you will recognize as familiar thoughts, not only in that instance, but thoughts you recycle all the time. And then you drop down a layer and you might say, well, how do I feel about that? And if you're able to drop down that layer, you may feel a sinking in your stomach. You may feel deflated. You may feel heat, like you're angry. There's some feelings, and that gets you a little bit more into movement. If you drop down a little lower, what are those feelings? What are the sensations of those feelings? There might be a charge, electrical feeling. And you keep moving down from those gross realms into what I call the subtle realms. There's an energy below that. There might be flashes of light. And as you keep moving down, you'll notice you'll start to spread out from the contracted thought process to the more liquidy feeling process to the more dispersed sensation, somatic process down into the energetic realms, maybe even into light. And eventually you will drop down into essence and you will wonder what you are upset about, because you're no longer replaying the negative and wounding associations. You're back to that original place where you're okay. You may like him or her to show up on time so the dinner didn't get cold, but it's not a life-threatening or a something that would destroy a relationship. And you then, in that essential place, would be able to share with your partner, you know, what's going on for you, and you know that you're disappointed and you wish you were otherwise, and you're hoping they're okay and that the lateness isn't a reflection of something and what's going on for them. And it actually can become an exceedingly intimate exchange. And then the warmth that was lost in the food is more than made up for in these open hearts. And so there, that's one way of moving through a contraction into a more spacious place. And there are many other ways of doing that as well.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And some of those other ways you do talk about in this book, because you also talk about some cases and how you've worked with clients. And it sounds to me like, because what I was going to come to now towards the end of our time together, is a section in your book that's called Cultivating Butterfly Consciousness. Mm-hmm. I love the way you describe it. And you're really talking about butterfly consciousness in a little bit with what you just said.
Yes.
So
do you want me to jump in here?
Yes.
Yeah. If you think about the passage from larva to caterpillar, mm-hmm. and then from caterpillar to chrysalis, and then chrysalis to butterfly. These are likened to the developmental stages. And we go through that over and over and over again. We just don't go through each one of these stages once. The larva and caterpillar are kind of who we are when we're ensconced in our defensive structure, our personalities, or our ego structures. And we haven't talked today and probably don't have time to break that down further. So generally speaking, mm-hmm. there are limitations. A caterpillar clings to twigs and sucks on leaves, and it's pretty prescribed where they're going to go and how they're going to get there. And that would be likened, say, in general to our personality. And then we hit something uncomfortable, like we've been talking about all this time, and we have to allow ourselves to a little bit fall apart, allow those defenses to dissolve into this white goop. If you open up a chrysalis, the caterpillar dissolves entirely into this white goop and then reconstitutes itself into a butterfly that emerges from the cocoon, is capable of flight, capable of being on land and in the air and moving around freely and much less prescribed in the way it's going to be. And that's a good image for the freedom. And so butterfly consciousness, for me, is an awareness of that whole cycle, which the caterpillar doesn't have. So the caterpillar pushes back away from all the discomfort because it's afraid of its death. The butterfly recognizes that what is the tomb for the caterpillar, the chrysalis, is the womb for this transformation. So once you have butterfly consciousness, like I said earlier, you move toward the discomfort because you know it is in the process of more and more liberation, more and more love, more and more connection, more and more flight. And so it's a little bit, I'm realizing about like aging. It's, you know, when I sit with clients who are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, or 50s, I recognize the stages that they're in and the struggles that they're having. And I also recognize that there is a path to liberating oneself from those struggles. And I'm careful about what I point out and what I don't. I don't tell them what it's like. I ask them to have the experience they're having in the moment and then to get a glimpse of what's unfolding. So they stay very close to their process and begin to bring that consciousness in an organic way that is right for them and their stage and for their moment in time.
That's wonderful. Is there anything else that you would want to share with me and my listeners before we wrap up?
I want to say that sustained and evolving intimacy is possible. One of the things that I hear a lot is that that's not possible. One cannot live with an open heart and just live that way. I mean, I don't think a completely open heart that stations is actually, maybe it is possible, but I have not seen it or experienced that myself. That we're always going through this sine wave where, you know, God is breaking the heart again and again and again until it stays open, which is this kind of theoretical place way out there. And so so the sine wave, the valleys and the peaks, are absolutely necessary fuel for the internal transformation. As we get larger and larger, really from a blue mountain lake probably to the ocean, and don't look for any landing place. There is no there. There is the next step and the next step and the next step in this infinite experience of self-enlargement. And so that, you know, this is possible, and a large portion of my client base is living this reality. And many people's client bases, I mean, not just mine. There are many people who have chosen this path and made love, recognize love as the universal solvent to growing who we are and our ability to care for one another and ourselves and our ability to love one another and ourselves and our ability to be who we glimpsed when we fell in love.
I'm speaking with Dr. Jep Saras about Undefended Love. That's the title of a book that she wrote that came out in 2000 that I highly recommend. Thank you so much for this beautiful discussion. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for this podcast and the invitation and the work that you're doing in the world. And, you know, it takes a village to create a village. And I think all of us are joining together to do that.
Who wants to grab a drink tonight? I know. It's only Tuesday and you gotta work tomorrow.
Thanks for tuning in to In the Balance with Susan Lambert. Produced by Walker Vreeland. Associate producer for online media is Taryn Kennedy. For more info or to listen to past episodes, go to inthebalance.life.
You got the kids and can't wake up hungover. Time. I got nothing but time. Time. I got nothing but